And now for an interview of Jesse Connolly, campaign manager for the Maine Won't Discriminate campaign, about the upcoming vote on November 8th in Maine. Jennifer Balkus talked with Jesse in his Portland office a few days ago.
I'm here with Jesse Connolly, campaign manager for Maine Won't Discriminate. On November 8th, Maine residents will be asked to vote on a referendum. The question is, do you want to repeal the law prohibiting discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation? Jesse, can you talk to me a little bit about this question and the relevance of November 8th?
Sure. We have been building for the past 6 or 7 months towards November 8th, which is the election day for us here in Maine. Essentially, what we're asking people to do is come out to vote and to vote no against the repeal effort of the law that was passed that bans discrimination based on sexual orientation this past session in the Maine legislature.
Can you talk a little bit about that original law? I believe it was March 2005?
Yeah, I mean, this past legislative session at the end of March, the Maine legislature, both the members of the House and Senate, overwhelmingly and with bipartisan support, passed a law that bans discrimination based on sexual orientation in 5 areas. It adds sexual orientation to the Maine Human Rights Act as a protected clause that is illegal to discriminate against. So essentially the process we're in right now is that every law that is passed in the state of Maine can be subject to what we call a people's veto. If citizens go forward and collect the necessary signatures to force an up or down vote on the actual repeal of the law that was passed. So essentially the timeline was that in March the legislature passed the bill, the governor signed the bill, and the Christian Civic League, our opponents, had 90 days to collect the needed signatures to put this on the ballot. They did that. It was verified by the Secretary of State in the middle of July, and it put it on this November's ballot. So that's kind of the situation that we're in right now.
Maine Won't Discriminate. What are the origins of this campaign?
This is a political action committee that's been around in different phases and different forms since 1995, when this issue was first debated on a statewide level. Maine Won't Discriminate is a coalition-based group made up of many different strategic partners, business partners, folks from all walks of life, all sides of the political spectrum have come forward to be a part of this campaign. So our efforts are a political action committee that's raising and spending money, talking to voters, trying to convince people to go out and vote no on one.
Could you give me a specific story? Have you knocked on doors yourself?
Yeah, sure. I think Maine people are at their core fair and true people. And they don't want to live in a state that essentially legalizes discrimination, the current situation that we're in now. So for us, we're trying to have one-on-one conversations with voters to get them to see the importance that, look, discrimination happens in Maine. Discrimination is real, and it hurts real Maine people. So we've gone through numerous doors. I've knocked on many doors and sort of had the conversations with individual voters. And I think when you have that one-on-one conversation, the issue becomes more real and more personal, and they understand the importance of going out to vote on November 8th. So for us, we've used many different mechanisms to reach voters, but we've always gone back to door knocking as one of the most effective.
So you've just knocked on my door. I'm Ms. Balkus. I say, hello. Yes, how can I help you?
Well, I just want to say I'm Jesse Connolly. I'm a volunteer with the Maine Won't Discriminate campaign. And do you know there's an election coming forward this November 8th? From there, we would most likely give them a piece of our literature. We'd have a conversation with them about what this law is and why it's on the ballot. And then we'd encourage them to vote no. We'd then ask how they think they're voting and if they needed any other additional material. So for us, we really want to focus in on the one-on-one conversations with voters, making sure that they understand what this law is and aren't confused by some of the other misnomers that are going out there, and also understand why this is important. So sometimes we tell them some personal stories of folks that have been discriminated against, that have been willing to come out and share their story in the public eye, hammer the issue home that it's important that if one person is discriminated against in Maine based on their sexual orientation, that's one too many, and that's why we need this law.
How are the stories collected from individuals who decided to share about their discriminated history?
Sure. There were 12 brave individuals that testified at the legislative hearing that were willing to speak in front of members of the legislature and all the press to talk about the discrimination that they have faced. There's also been a great report that's been released in the past couple of weeks by the Center for the Prevention of Hate Crime Violence at the University of Southern Maine that talks about where the names have been changed, but essentially the real stories of folks that have come and told their story about the discrimination that they face. So for us, it's important to, one, respect people's privacy, but when folks are brave enough to share their story, try to highlight that as a reason for why this law is needed.
Will you share a story with me now?
Sure. There was a gentleman from Bangor, which is in northern Maine, who was working for an insurance company, had been there for about 3 months, was doing a fantastic job, have gotten great reviews, went to lunch one day with his partner, and one of the company executives saw him come back, give a kiss on his cheek to his male partner, was later that day brought into 3 or 4 different sets of meetings where they had indicated that there were some internal reviews going on around his job performance. They were had become very unsatisfactory in the last few weeks, and he was terminated later that day. So that's just one of the stories of folks that have been brave enough to come and say, look, there's no other reason that I was let go from my job other than I chose to love someone that was out of the cultural norm or out of the mainstream.
I imagine when you knock on someone's door, and if you have an opportunity to share a story like this one, you may have an array of answers. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think most people take people's word on face value. Most people go through different stages of reaction. Some are utterly dismayed and horrified and forces them to go out and get more involved, become more of a part of our campaign, be willing to go out and be a volunteer themselves. Others are more reserved in their comments or in their general reaction, but we really think that it's important for that to get out there and for people to have time to think about that and hopefully be a motivating factor for them to go vote on November 8th.
You won't be able to give me an empirical answer, but what is your impression of the kind of response that you've had from campaigning, either yourself personally or perhaps feedback you've gotten from your crew?
I think that, as we kind of indicated earlier, Maine people are generally supportive of this issue. But as with the past two campaigns that have failed on our side of the aisle, we really need to go out and encourage folks to go vote early, either in person or absentee balloting, and essentially encourage them that it's not just okay to say you're against discrimination, that you need to go out and actually pull the lever and go vote on November 8th. So for us, we're cautiously optimistic about the success that our campaigning efforts have done. We think we've definitely raised the profile of this issue and have given it the publicity that it needs in order to have a successful election. So we're leaving no stone unturned and trying to do as much as we can to make sure that folks understand that the most important thing they can do on November 8th is go out and vote.
Do you experience sometimes the response, well, I don't really see how this affects me? Does that happen? And what is the reaction to a response like that one?
That is sometimes a response that we see. I'm a straight white man. This is something that doesn't individually affect me, but it's affected some of my friends and some of my colleagues. I think on the whole, men and women that live in Maine either work with someone or in a family with someone or know someone that is gay or lesbian. And I think it's important to sort of think back and imagine what it'd be like to be in their shoes and essentially have a law that says you can get kicked out of an apartment, you can be denied a place to stay, you can lose your mortgage, you can have educational opportunities not happen, and you can lose your job based solely on who you choose to love. So I think even though it might not affect a majority of Mainers, that direct connection that they have to someone, or just the sort of the tolerance and understanding that I hope all Mainers have about wanting to live in a state that values all of its citizens.
You mentioned something about two campaigns that were somewhat failures. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. This isn't a new issue to Maine, and this isn't a new issue to Maine voters. This first bill that tried to ban discrimination based on sexual orientation was actually put into the Maine legislature in 1977. That's 28 years ago. This bill wasn't passed and signed by the governor until 1997. In 1998, there was a repeal effort similar to what we have going on now that we ultimately lost. And in 2000, the legislature passed it, but the then governor, Governor Angus King, indicated that he wanted the voters to approve this issue. So he sent it to referendum, and it ultimately failed as well. So we're hoping the third time is the charm. We think we're doing a couple things a little bit differently in this campaign that haven't been done in past campaigns. And we're really hoping for a successful no vote on November 8th.
What could have accounted for the failures? Is that a fair question?
I don't want to point fingers and say they could have done this or they could have done that. I think what's important is that we talk about what I think we're doing a little bit differently this time around. One, this campaign is bipartisan. I'm a very strong Democrat, but I'm a very strong Republican who's essentially our senior advisor for the campaign. We have had different members of the legislature, both Democrat, Republican, Independents, and Green, that have supported this. This is a statewide campaign. We're canvassing and campaigning from the southernmost tip of York and Kittery to the northern part of the state in Fort Kent and everywhere in between that. We're also a mainstream campaign. groups like the Maine Innkeepers Association, the Maine State Chamber of Commerce, the Maine Education Association have all signed on in support of our campaign. And fourthly, you know, we're running a professional campaign. We have television ads that are up and running. We have direct mail pieces that are hitting. We have a field program that's strong and talking to a lot of voters. So we're really leaving no stone unturned, trying to really make sure that Maine voters have the accurate information that they need to go out and hopefully vote no on November 8th.
Here in the Portland satellite office waiting for you in the lobby, I saw two youth come in, present themselves and say, we would like to represent this campaign at our school. What can we do? How can we do it? What does that attest to? Someone is coming to your office saying they want to bring it to their school.
Yeah. I've been just so overwhelmed and satisfied and proud to live in a state where the campaign has grown enough where people feel comfortable coming into our office, asking what can they do to help right now, asking what can they do to make this campaign a part of their everyday lives. It's really important that this, you know, sort of groundswell of emotion and momentum continues to build to make sure that we have the needed votes on election day to win this. So for us to have people walk into our office unsolicited, asking what can they do to help or how can they bring this campaign to their, either their school or to their home is a fantastic thing. And I'm very proud that our campaign has been able to build that reputation, that folks want to come and be a part of it.
A number of our listeners are Maine residents and a number of New Hampshire residents, mm-hmm. of course. First, about Maine residents and direct impact, what happens on November 8th? Could you project for me if it passes, if it fails? Could you comment on that?
November 8th will be a yes or no vote. If the no side, if our side prevails on November 9th, this bill that's already been signed goes into law and can start to be enforced. Individuals that have been discriminated against from November 9th onward have some sort of legal recourse and the same legal rights that every other Mainer has and deserves, and hopefully will be used as a deterrent to deter discrimination from happening in the first place. No one really wants to go through costly legal battle or some sort of court case to get to an end. They really want it never to happen in the first place, and that's my hope of what this law can do. If we're unfortunate enough to lose, this goes back to the legislature to potentially think about trying to put this through the legislative process again. But it's really important that we try to, for once and for all, close the door on a 28-year chapter, 28-year struggle that is, to me, such an integral part of what our state needs and what all of our Maine residents deserve.
Not all states have legislation specifying anti-discrimination. In fact, New Hampshire and Maine, of course, are among the minority that do.
Yeah, I think it's important that Maine continues to be a leader across the country. But this is also an issue that shouldn't be really feared. Every New England state minus Maine has this protections currently on the books. New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Connecticut, and Rhode Island, and Vermont all enjoy these protections, and nothing's gone haywire there. So for us, it's really important that this law has been passed, that this is the will of the legislature and the governor, and that we see out that will and make sure that, you know, if there's one person that has been discriminated against based on who they choose to love, that's one person too many, and that's exactly why this law is needed.
If I understand, this law doesn't address schools or children, am I correct?
No, it does address education. So essentially, the way that is defined is that no one can be denied an educational opportunity, whether that opportunity is in participating in after-school activities or in classes based on their sexual orientation, being denied entrance into individual schools, public schools in our state, or being denied the ability to grow as a student based on their sexual orientation. So we really hope, once again, that these can all be preventative measures, that this law is a preventative measure as it moves forward.
Sometimes it's really great to be wrong. Certainly I enjoy reading in the New Hampshire papers about Maine Won't Discriminate. I feel like just the fact that you're our neighbor and we share some of the same communities, some communities don't have borders. You know, if you live 5 minutes from a coffee house that's across the border, you're going to go there.
Sure.
So I feel that just the fact that Maine is tackling this question and it's in New Hampshire papers, discussion is being generated around these issues. What about general conscious raising, not just focusing on the November 8th vote, which is very important? Mm-hmm. I don't want to...
I think it's, you know, we're thrilled that papers like the Portsmouth Herald have come out and endorsed Maine Won't Discriminate and No on One, as they did last week. This is an issue that affects not only Mainers, but also our neighbors to the south and to the west in New Hampshire. So it's important that we try to come together as one New England community and help pass this issue. But as far as the issue of the underlying goals and principles, I think the conversation we're truly having right now is whether you think it's okay to fire someone because they're gay. To me, I couldn't even imagine going through a situation where I was a stellar employee, had done nothing wrong, but someone fired me just solely based on who I choose to love. So I think what we're truly talking about, I believe, is a civil rights issue. There have been many different instances of civil rights movements that have taken place over the course of our history, both as a nation and as a state, that are important. And I think this is one of those civil rights struggles and fights that has happened over the past 28 years that we have a golden opportunity to help close the book on, or at least part of that book on. It's really important that, you know, we think about this issue and this referendum in the context of the overall general way that we want to treat our friends and treat our neighbors that live in the state of Maine, whether we live in New Hampshire or otherwise. So for us, it's really, truly important that we think about how important this issue is and how important this is in the overall civil rights struggle for GLBT Americans and GLBT Mainers.
What is the message you would like to leave our listeners with today?
We're several days out to the election. There's a lot of work that needs to happen. I encourage folks to go to our website, www.mainewon'tdiscriminate.com. I encourage folks to consider volunteering or contributing to our campaign. But ultimately, I want people to sort of think about this in an effort of, we live in a state right now that essentially legalizes discrimination. We have a chance to end that and to stop that. And for us, we need to remind every Mainer that discrimination is real. Discrimination happens in our state, and it hurts real Maine people. And that's why it's so important for folks to go out and vote no on one next Tuesday.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is Jennifer Belkis for Making Waves. Thank you for listening.
In a coffee shop in our city, which is every coffee shop in every city, on a day which is every day. I picked up a magazine, which is every magazine. I read a story, then I forgot it right away. And they say goldfish have no memory. I guess their lives are much like mine. And the little plastic castle is a surprise every time. And it's hard to say if they're happy, but they don't seem much to mine. Yeah! From the shape of your shaved head, I recognized your silhouette as you walked out of the sun and sat down. And the sight of your sleepy smile eclipsed all the other people as they paused to sneer at the two girls from out of town. I said, look at you this morning. You are by far the cutest. But be careful getting coffee. I think these people wanna shoot us. Or maybe there's some kind of local competition here to see who can be the rudest. Declining mind, like what I happen to be wearing the day that someone takes a picture is my new statement for all of womankind. And I wish they could see us now in leather bras and rubber shorts, like some ridiculous new team uniform for some ridiculous new sport. Quick, someone call the girl police and file a report. Than every city on a day, which is every day.
That was Little Plastic Castle by Ani DeFranco. And now for Between the Lines, independent radio out of Bridgeport, Connecticut.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present John Nichols of The Nation magazine, who examines the indictment of Vice President Dick Cheney's Chief of Staff, Louis Libby, and the possible involvement of his boss in the ongoing investigation into the White House disclosure of a CIA agent's identity. John Sifton, a researcher with Human Rights Watch, who explains why there is strong opposition to the Bush administration's attempt to legalize the abuse of prisoners held by U.S. intelligence agencies. And Christy Pardue of School of the Americas Watch, who discusses plans for the 15th annual protest at Fort Benning, Georgia, in the ongoing effort to close the Pentagon school that has trained Latin American human rights abusers. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
4 years ago, in a carnival-like atmosphere, Brazil destroyed 100,000 small arms, a one-day record. Tens of thousands of people filled the streets of Rio to watch construction trucks crush the guns. Yet guns such as rifles and pistols are still the leading cause of death of men in Brazil. This spring, the South American nation scored second in the number of gun deaths in a global survey by the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, or UNESCO. In response to the violence, the state of Rio de Janeiro has launched a massive gun buyback campaign which has collected over 300,000 weapons in the last year and a half. Predictably, Brazil's gun lobby opposes the ban on small arm sales. They're joined by many urban residents who buy guns for protection against crime. Viva Rio, the reform group behind the buyback campaign, has run TV ads featuring sexy soap opera stars with the tagline, "Choose your guns or me." Churches have also gotten involved in gun collections, including sponsoring over 100 sites for the National Day of Disarmament, which collected 1,000 weapons, but there are an estimated 8.7 million illegal guns on Brazil's streets. Congressman Rick Larson of Seattle is a self-proclaimed New Democrat, who supported the Bush agenda several times by voting in favor of the bankruptcy bill, repealing the estate tax, and the tort reform bill, backed by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Larson is among the 15 faithless House Democrats identified by the American Prospect magazine for abandoning the party's progressive economic message. Others on the list include Jane Harman of Los Angeles and Greg Meeks of Queens, New York. Despite the defections, House Democrats have shown little will to discipline their maverick members, and few progressives have run against New Democrats in primary elections. In contrast, conservative groups like the Club for Growth often run primary challenges against moderate Republicans, disparaged as rhinos, or Republicans in name only. Colin Peterson, who represents a rural Minnesota district, voted with the GOP more often than any House Democrat. In response, House Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi threatened to take away Peterson's high-ranking seat on the House Agriculture Committee, but backed down after the maverick congressman promised to do a better job in supporting the Democratic agenda. Some progressives are now beginning to organize against corporate Democrats. An ad by the Project for an Accountable Congress recently ran in the district of Congressman Jack Tanner, attacking the New Democrat for taking over $17,000 in campaign contributions from Walmart. Launched in 2003, the Apollo Alliance was built to mobilize federal dollars for energy independence and in the process create good jobs with new technology, bolster national security, and reduce carbon emissions. Liberals and conservatives quickly embraced the vision of the alliance, which received backing from labor and environmental groups and nine governors for a decade-long $300 billion investment in clean energy. Yet the alliance has failed to lobby for many initiatives on Capitol Hill, while the Bush administration pushed through an energy bill full of giveaways for the fossil fuel industry. Instead of pushing for change in Congress, the alliance has lobbied for energy reform at the state level. In Pennsylvania, for example, it worked with green groups and the United Steelworkers to adopt a renewable portfolio standard requiring 18% of the state's power supply to come from clean sources by 2020. But according to The Grist, an online environmental magazine, this go-slow approach has frustrated a lot of people inside the Apollo Alliance. Founding director Bracken Hendricks recently left the alliance to team up with two political consultants who wrote the paper The Death of Environmentalism that encourages Greens to return to movement building. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Bill Cosentino.
After 2 years of investigation, Special Counsel Patrick Fitzgerald unveiled what he has learned thus far in looking into who in the White House leaked the identity of a covert CIA agent. On October 28th, Fitzgerald indicted Vice President Dick Cheney's Chief of Staff Louis Libby on two counts of making false statements to federal agents, two counts of perjury, and one count of obstruction of justice for misleading and deceiving the grand jury about how he learned that former U.S. Ambassador and White House critic Joseph Wilson's wife, Valerie Plame, worked as a CIA operative. Vice President Cheney, it turns out, was the originator of information passed on to Libby, who in turn spoke with reporters about Wilson's wife's job at the CIA. While Fitzgerald did not indict President Bush's senior advisor Karl Rove, the federal prosecutor announced that the investigation of Rove and others would continue. Republicans have done their best to minimize Libby's indictment, while anti-war activists and 40 members of the House have urged Fitzgerald to broaden the scope of his probe, focusing on the lies and distortions used by the Bush administration to win support for their war with Iraq. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with John Nichols, Washington correspondent for The Nation magazine. Nichols, author of a biography on Dick Cheney, examines the indictment of Louis Libby and the possible involvement of his boss in the scandals emanating from the dishonest justifications for the Iraq War.
Louis Libby is one of the smartest people in the administration, dramatically smarter than Bush and a good deal smarter than Cheney. He has been an integral player in the hawk right-wing neoconservative side of the political equation since the early 1980s, when Paul Wolfowitz brought him into the Reagan administration. He was the architect of the defense planning document in 1992 that really became the model for the whole neoconservative movement, the idea that the United States should aggressively launch wars around the world with the sole purpose of maintaining the economic and political power of the U.S. And finally, since the beginning of the Bush administration, he has been the prime mover, and I emphasize the prime mover, on every White House committee and group that has sought to sell the war in Iraq. It was Scooter Libby who was at the core of the concept of blowing the weapons of mass destruction argument, you know, way out of proportion. He's been the one peddling, more than anyone else except Cheney himself, the idea of an Iraq-Al-Qaeda connection. This is a very, very big player. If we had a serious media in the United States, which we do not have, but if we had a serious media in the United States, the taking down of Scooter Libby would be treated as one of the biggest events of the last 20 years. But the bigger deal, the more important thing, is that when Patrick Fitzgerald announced the indictment of Scooter Libby, he also said, it's not over. He has asked for a new grand jury to be impaneled. He has leased dramatically larger office space in the District of Columbia. And despite the fact that he's tried to talk down expectations, I think anyone who's read the indictment knows that this guy continues to look very, very seriously at much bigger players even than Scooter Libby. And, of course, when we say that, we mean Dick Cheney.
It seems that Louis Libby, by lying as he did to the grand jury, forestalled the Fitzgerald investigation from going forward in the period right before the 2004 presidential election. After all, this investigation began in 2003. The stonewalling actually took this story off the front pages during that critical moment in time when Bush and Cheney were running for re-election. They succeeded in stopping this scandal in its tracks, and now it's come out. But they've been re-elected. They have the reins of power for the next 4 years after that election.
A, you're right. Let me begin by saying you're exactly right. And it's shame on some of us in journalism for not writing that story yet, but I'm going to steal the idea from you. If we take a look at what is almost undebatable, in fact, I would say it is undebatable, that Dick Cheney and Scooter Libby did, which was conspire to lie and do it on a time frame and in a time schedule with the goal of preventing the American people from knowing the truth of what was going on with their government at a time of election, you can impeach them. I emphasize that in most other countries around the world, if we had a scandal that had reached this level, there would be talk about removing the government. In Britain, in Japan, in France, it would be, of course, an ongoing, very aggressive discussion about whether to have a vote of confidence in Parliament or whether to remove the government in some other form, force a new election. In the United States, we don't have the capacity to force a new election. But we do have the power of impeachment, which is first based on investigation and then based on trial, should that investigation yield sufficient evidence to merit removal. And I am saddened, frankly, that Democrats didn't respond immediately after the Fitzgerald indictment came down with talk of impeachment. It is appropriate at this point. It is not a radical idea. It is not a crazy partisan notion. It is the appropriate move. And I hope very, very passionately that some members of Congress will begin to entertain that discussion sooner rather than later. I've spoken with John Conyers, the ranking Democrat on the House Judiciary Committee, within the last few weeks about this exact matter. And it's clear that Conyers is very interested in the issue of impeachment. In fact, speaks of it openly and in a very intelligent, very thoughtful way. He's concerned, frankly, that the Republican majority will just laugh the suggestion off and that it won't advance. But what I've suggested to members of the House and others who've asked me about this issue and who I've talked with about it, that's not your job. It's not your job to be a political pundit to figure out whether the right thing to do works easily or whether it advances quickly. Your job is to take the right action. And on the basis of this indictment, the proper action at this point is to call Dick Cheney before the House and the Senate, before the relevant committees, to explain his actions and to answer under oath questions regarding how his office operated, why his office did what it did with regard to Joe Wilson and Valerie Plame, and how that related to efforts to cover up the lies on which the war in Iraq was based. The American people want us to hold the government accountable. The problem is that our opposition party and our media are not doing a good job of it.
That was John Nichols, Washington correspondent with The Nation magazine. Read Nichols' column online at www.thenation.com. Nichols' biography on Dick Cheney will be published this fall by the New Press under the title The Rise and Rise of Richard B. Cheney. Months after the dramatic revelations about the torture of U.S.-held prisoners at Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq and other documented accounts of the abuse of detainees at American prisons in Afghanistan and at the U.S. naval base in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, the Senate moved to prohibit such ill treatment. In October, the Senate, by a 90-9 vote, approved legislation sponsored by Senators John McCain and Lindsey Graham that would prohibit the military and the CIA from employing, quote, cruel, inhumane, or degrading treatment, end quote, of any U.S.-held detainee anywhere in the world. But the Bush administration, authors of directives that allowed for certain forms of abuse leading to international condemnation, is now attempting to create a legal exception where abuse of American-held prisoners will be legally permitted. Vice President Dick Cheney and CIA Director Porter Goss have proposed the inclusion of a presidential waiver in the McCain bill. The proposed waiver states, quote, "The measure shall not apply with respect to clandestine counterterrorism operations conducted abroad with respect to terrorists who are not citizens of the United States, that are carried out by an element of the U.S. government other than the Department of Defense, if the president determines that such operations are vital to the protection of the U.S. or its citizens from terrorist attack," end quote. The waiver is now being considered by a House Senate conference committee. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with John Sifton, a researcher with Human Rights Watch, who explains why there is strong opposition to the Bush administration's attempt to legalize the abuse of prisoners held by U.S. intelligence agencies.
Amazingly enough, the administration has pushed some House members to kill the amendment, to get rid of it, or create an exception which allows non-military personnel potentially to engage in cruel, inhumane, degrading treatment. Nobody's talking about torture here. It's something called cruel, inhumane, degrading treatment, which is this sort of lesser form of torture. I found throughout my life that there is really a continuum here. And when you allow interrogators to use mistreatment, they usually end up torturing as well. So for us, the distinction doesn't give us much comfort. The administration's position, amazing as it is that the CIA and other non-military personnel abroad who are working for the U.S. government are not legally obliged to refrain from cruel, inhumane, degrading treatment, CID. That's their position. And it's based on a very convoluted constitutional argument, which I won't bore anybody with here, but, you know, that's their position. It doesn't matter that the international community rejects that legal argument. It doesn't matter that, you know, in the future a court would probably reject that argument. Even a conservative judge would probably shake his head at the legal reasoning that arrives at it, but that's what they're trying to do.
Vice President Cheney is the one behind this move, assuming that President Bush is on board too. How far do you think they'll go with this, and how much support does this exceptionalism for mistreatment have in the Congress, do you think?
Well, the president isn't going to veto the entire defense authorization bill, although he's threatened to. He's not going to do that. He can't do that. You can't veto a defense authorization bill in the middle of a war. It's just not feasible. So what they're trying to do is get the House to fight it. They may succeed. They may get them to water down the provision or even put in a poison pill that forces the amendment sponsors to kill it, you know, because it's potentially possible that we could end up with a net loss if they add an exception in. And in that case, John McCain and the other supporters of this amendment would want to withdraw the entire amendment rather than have it be watered down in a damaging way. Cheney is behind this in many ways, but the real people we should be talking about are the new chief of staff who's replaced Scooter Libby, David Addington. He's the lawyer who came up with the legal argument on which this exception is founded. David Addington, who many Americans don't know about, has been at the forefront of a lot of efforts out of the vice president's office to expand presidential authority, water down criminal and constitutional curtailment of the president's authority to engage in illegal activities. I mean, Americans are not perhaps familiar with the extent to which Cheney's office has attempted to create legal arguments for unfettered presidential power. Quite interesting academically, but it really just boils down to one thing. The argument is the president can do whatever he wants to do. And as a human rights organization, Human Rights Watch is appalled by that notion. Under that theory, people like Augusto Pinochet, Slobodan Milosevic could have a defense in a court and say, you know, I had to do what I had to do because I'm the president.
And as we come up to the Bush administration's attempt to carve out this legalization of abuse for U.S.-held detainees, what can the public do to, number one, hold the higher officials accountable for what's taken place regarding U.S. detainees in U.S. custody? And what can citizens do to get involved to stop this exceptional amendment from going forward?
What the Congress needs to do to really get to the bottom of this is to demand that a special counsel be appointed to investigate the leadership in the Pentagon and civilian levels of government, what criminal actions they may have taken part in, but also just what went on that allowed this to happen. There are two ways of doing it. One is Congress could convene a special commission on the lines of the 9/11 commission to sort of say what went wrong. An independent commission, not like the commissions that the Pentagon has appointed, which have been extremely problematic on both internal and external relations, but a real independent commission, bipartisan, that would look at the issues. That would be one level. The next thing would be actually to have a special counsel with prosecutorial power. That would be even better. So what people can do is write to their senator, write to their congressperson, and say, I don't want low-level soldiers to be held accountable. I don't think privates and sergeants should be held accountable, or even captains. I want to know about the majors and the colonels and the major generals who instructed military intelligence personnel to take the gloves off. I want to know about the civilian leaders in the Pentagon who told those generals that they could do that. I want to know who knew what when at the highest levels of government.
That was John Sifton, a terrorism and counterterrorism researcher with Human Rights Watch. Contact the group by calling area code 212-290-4700 or visit their website at www.hrw.org. This year marks the 15th anniversary of efforts by School of the Americas Watch to close down a training facility for Latin American military officers located at Fort Benning in Columbus, Georgia. November 18th through the 20th, nonviolent activists will gather at the gates of Fort Benning to demonstrate solidarity with the victims of human rights abuses committed by graduates of the school, long known as the School of the Americas and now called the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation, or WINSEC. With music, pageantry, and prayer, they will call for the closure of the school. And, as in past years, some will likely be arrested in acts of civil disobedience and serve several months in prison for their witness. Every year for the past 15 years, a bill to close the school has been introduced in the House of Representatives. It came within a few votes of passing in 1999, but support dropped after the school changed its name and after the 9/11 attacks. This year, the bill has 130 bipartisan co-sponsors and, according to activists, the best chance of passing since 1999. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Christy Pardue, communications coordinator for SOA Watch, based in Washington, D.C. and Columbus, Georgia. She explains that although media coverage of U.S. military operations in Latin America have received less attention than Iraq and Afghanistan, the Bush administration is heavily invested militarily in the region. And she says there is bipartisan interest in cutting the budget for the School of the Americas, which they estimate to be about $20 million a year.
The U.S. military is heavily focused on what's going on in Latin America. Donald Rumsfeld was just touring the region and encouraging regional leaders to be making sure that their security ideas are working well with their Latin American neighbors. But this isn't something that we're seeing reported in the newspapers.
I know Venezuela announced last year that it's no longer going to send troops to the SOA for training, which isn't really a surprise given relations between Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez and the Bush administration. In fact, it's surprising that the Bush administration didn't cut Venezuela out of the program first. How did Venezuela make that decision?
Last year, after a meeting that was led by Father Roy Bourgeois, who's the founder of SOA Watch, and other human rights and religious leaders from the United States, a meeting that those folks had with both the president of Venezuela, Hugo Chavez, and the vice president of Venezuela, Venezuela announced that they would no longer send troops to train at the school. They said the school has a reputation for fomenting coups, for training people who become human rights abusers, and we don't want to have anything to do with it, and we won't be sending soldiers to train there anymore. It was a really exciting success for the SOA Watch movement, and the movement today continues to work to create relationships with grassroots organizations in Latin America and with Latin American governments, encouraging other governments to take the same sort of stand.
Are any countries barred from attending by the U.S.?
At least 7 countries have publicly refused to sign an agreement that exempts U.S. soldiers from prosecution for war crimes. Those countries are Brazil, Costa Rica, Ecuador, Paraguay, Peru, Uruguay, and Venezuela. Those countries currently would be ineligible to receive scholarships to send soldiers from their countries to the School of the Americas.
Christy Pardue, what is the status of the bill this year to close the school? And is there any more interest in closing it as a way of cutting the budget to help pay for Hurricane Katrina recovery?
We've heard from a number of Republican co-sponsors that, yes, they realize that extraneous programs in the military need to be cut. They're looking to see where they can cut funding. And next year, we will have a vote in Congress about this bill, and we are in an incredible position to win. We're looking to win a vote in the House next year to shut this down. This bill has bipartisan support. We really see this as an issue that's beyond partisan politics.
A spokesman for the School of the Americas says all the students take courses in human rights. Do you think that's improved the situation in terms of the number of atrocities committed by graduates?
You know, the school has always had an official line about why it's in existence. It was to learn jungle combat. It was to fight the spread of communism. More recently, we hear about fighting drugs and fighting terrorism is the big thing now. And a lot of the public affairs officials say that the role of the school now is spreading democracy, that they're teaching human rights and democracy. There was an instructor, Major Joseph Blair, who spoke out against the school a number of years ago in the mid-1990s, and he said that human rights training has been happening at the school for more than 20 years at that point. So that would mean that there was human rights going on throughout the 1980s. We have so much information at this point about graduates that were coming to the school, returning to their home countries, and committing human rights abuses, you know, within months of the training that they received at the School of the Americas. So I think it really calls into question what is the role of this human rights training that's happening at the school.
But maybe things are getting better. Do you have any information about more recent abuses?
You know, it takes a very long time to hear about human rights abuses and to be able to connect them to graduates of the school. The work that SOA Watch has done over the past 15 years has, with no resources and with almost all volunteer work, has turned up over 600 graduates that have committed human rights abuses in their home countries. And we continue to partner with organizations in Latin America to hear about human rights abuses, to try to discover the names that are connected with those human rights abuses, and then to research whether any of those students have trained at the School of the Americas in any of its incarnations. We also continue to call for an independent investigation into the human rights allegations that have been brought by so many different organizations. And, you know, SOA Watch's position is we call for the closure of the school, for an investigation into past abuses, and also for reparations to be made to the victims of the school. There's never been any acknowledgement by the U.S. government of its complicity in human rights abuses in Latin America. Whenever human rights organizations have brought proof of allegations of human rights abuses, their response has been to put more money into their public relations campaign.
That was Christy Pardue of School of the Americas Watch. This year, the protest will include more participation by Latin American supporters of the effort to close the school. For more information, contact SOA Watch at area code 202-234-3440 or visit their website at www.soaw.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
And thanks for listening to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice. The Making Waves crew is Amy Antonucci, Steve Diamond, Tom Jackson, Stanley Longstaff, Adam Marowitz, Dorian Paradise, Damon Thomas, and Jeff White. We welcome and need your participation too. Please email nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com to get involved. You can live stream our show on Saturdays from 2 to 4 if you're not in range of the station by going to www.wirenh.com. Remember that WSCA is new and growing and hoping for your membership and participation. Go to www.wscafm.org to join and learn more. Tune in next Saturday from 2 to 4 for our next Making Waves program. We leave you with this quote by Rosa Parks. Each person must live their life as a model for others.